Hello and welcome to the Indie Business Podcast. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. Today's show is sponsored by Essential Wholesale. That's right, at EssentialWholesale.com, they have just launched a brand new website. It is filled with all kinds of information and helpful tips to help you manufacture and market fantastic cosmetics products. And they also have a great private label selector where you can select all the ingredients that you want in your cosmetics in very small quantities. This is a great way to help you expand your business without unnecessarily increasing your costs. If you haven't visited Essential Wholesale lately, you need to head on over there today. EssentialWholesale.com for more information. Well, you know, this past weekend, I went to Austin, Texas for the first time. I had a fantastic time there. I was the keynote speaker and also delivered a presentation on some cosmetics and beauty industry regulatory issues that are happening right now in our industry. And I was invited by Elin Criswell and Starlene Moore, who are Texas soap makers, and they started an organization called the Lone Star Soap and Toiletries Organization, and they had their first conference just this past weekend. And for a first-time conference, I'm telling you, this was fantastic. There were about 60 people there from all over the state of Texas and some from outside of Texas as well. We had a fantastic time talking about social media, how to grow your business efficiently without raising your costs too much, and also some of the latest things for you to look out for if you're a cosmetics manufacturer where new regulations are concerned. And I want to mention something about that. You know, a lot of my audience is composed of cosmetics manufacturers because I'm the president of the Indie Beauty Network. So we're going to be talking a lot more on my show about the new regulations, how they might affect businesses, but most specifically how you as an independent business owner can impact public policy where regulations and laws are concerned that affect your business. This is a really huge issue. Those of you who have been following what Congress has been doing lately where manufacturing is concerned might be familiar with what happened last year with the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which ended up putting a ton of small businesses out of business in one fell swoop. We did a show on that last year in 2009. You can go to indiebusinessradio.com and look at one of the first shows of last year, actually, is what we covered there. So you can just search on Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, and you can find that show and get an idea of how congressional action is affecting small businesses in ways that it's never done so before, especially in the manufacturing sector. Because remember, there's one set of laws that applies to everyone, generally speaking. In order to recognize that small manufacturers operate differently from large companies, we need to impact public policy and let our lawmakers in every state, that's your state, let them know that you manufacture differently from large multinational million-dollar and billion-dollar companies. You're a different kind of company, and you require a different set of specific, carefully tailored regulations so that you can manufacture safe and good products, that you can protect your customers, and that you can also have a level playing field that would allow you to compete without unnecessarily putting you out of business. These are some really important issues, and I'm going to use this show over the course of the next several months to focus more specifically on these issues. But in the meantime, I will continue to have some fantastic authors and small business experts and people that have a lot of knowledge about things that can help you run your business more effectively. And today we have a professor at the Wharton School of Business. His name is Professor David Rebstein, and he is the co-author with several other people of a book called Marketing Metrics, The Definitive Guide to Measuring Marketing Performance. This is a fantastic book. It's really kind of a textbook, it seems like to me. There are a lot of very, very helpful nuggets of information here that can help you with your business. And Professor Reeve Stein, and I hope I'm saying his name properly, because maybe I'm not, is going to be joining us on today's show, but I don't think he's here yet. The reason he's not here yet is because of a mistake I made. I sent him the call-in information for the show, but I sent it to him a little bit late before the show started. And so my suspicion is that he's looking through his email right now so he can get the show call-in information and join us here. But while we're waiting for him, and there he is, I believe. Is this our guest today?
Yes, this is.
Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you. I just introduced you, and what timing you have, actually.
Wow.
Of course, I apologize for sending that show information a little bit late. I'm very excited to have you here. Your new book, Marketing Metrics, The Definitive Guide to Measuring Marketing Performance, is just out, and this is a fantastic book. Of course, I've been looking over it over the past couple of months. Professor, tell us a little bit about why you wrote this book and why you think it's important.
Well, it turns out that today, more and more, we are constantly being measured on our overall performance, and so the question is, what are the key measures that we should be using for trying to assess this, and making sure that we have all of the right measures correctly understood? What I do find is more and more companies are using various terms, but they are actually referring to various different things. So it's really essential that we try and come up with some clarity as to what it is we're really trying to measure.
And looking at your book and I've, you know, reading through the chapters, there are lots of different things that businesses can measure. There's like an seemingly endless number of them. So, Professor, for small businesses and very small companies, that is companies with like one or two employees, which is what our audience has, what is the importance of being able to measure certain things? I mean, can you just kind of tell what's working and what's not working and run with that? Or do you really need to take the time out to, you know, actually do some measurement? And why is...
Hello?
Professor?
Yes.
Yes, hi. I'm sorry. Did you hear my...
Yeah, so I did just hear your question, and I think the answer is, you know, you can tell if things are working or not working, but then the question is, if they're not working, the question is, why are they not working? And can we detect, you know, what the real underlying causes of the particular problems are? So even if you're a small business, you want to know, you know, are we having problems because we're not delivering things on time, or are we having problems because people aren't satisfied with what it is that we are delivering, or what exactly is the nature of the problem?
And do you have to have any specific background or educational expertise in order to make some of the more basic measurements to expand your business and grow in an efficient way?
You really don't. You know, it is possible to try and figure out what's going on with your business without necessarily a large amount of background, let's say, marketing research per se. So a very simple thing is I want to know if my customers are satisfied. And so what I need to be doing is on a regular basis trying to try and measure levels of customer satisfaction. So of the clients that you've got, on a simple, you know, scale, you could be asking your customers how satisfied are you from 1 to 10 and just be regularly trying to track that as an example.
So that actually is a really good example. So let's start with that. And that's such a basic question that all business owners need to continually answer, right? Are my customers satisfied? And then even before that, what is their basic general satisfaction level, because we can all describe satisfied, quote unquote, in a different way, right?
No, that's definitely the case.
So let's say you're a small business owner and you're not familiar with this, and what you've been doing so far is, you know, every now and then when you send a product out, someone sends you an email and says how great it was and how happy they are. And, you know, maybe every now and then someone shows up on Facebook and says, you know, I got my order and it was wonderful. What sorts of things can small business owners do, Professor, to drive this process? Can we input certain systems into our business so that we're not just waiting for people to tell us, that we're kind of proactively measuring and collecting this information?
So, you know, particularly if you're a small business, one of the things that's really critical is what are the number of customers that I'm able to attract? and am I retaining and keeping the customers that I'm trying to appeal to? So it turns out that if they're not satisfied, then your ability to retain them would be going down. So an indicator of whether or not you're performing well is you keep getting customers, but you keep losing customers as well.
So you're saying you can be continually customers, but if you're not finding out about the satisfaction level of existing ones, then you essentially will have a metric that will be out of balance.
Right. So sometimes what it is that we refer to as a leaky bucket. I keep bringing customers into the business, but they keep draining right out the bottom end. And there's such a great advantage of being able to retain your customers such that you don't always end up having to replenish your customer base.
So what are some things that we can do to do that? I mean, we obviously have to have a good product, right? The product has to be good. So outside of that, what are some of the things that small businesses can do to avoid that leaky bucket? That sounds like a big problem that could sort of get out of hand almost without you even noticing it.
Well, it's really one of the advantages of having some good metrics is you can try and find out what it is that customers aren't satisfied about. So one, as you referred to, is the overall level of satisfaction, but then the question is, are there some particulars that they're not satisfied with? So it could be something as simple as, you know, the hours that you keep or how quickly you deliver or the courtesy of some of the service, et cetera. And those are all discoverable by measurement. Now, of course, if you're a really small business, you interact with the customers and you have some sense of it. The question is, can you try and not just use the anecdotes, but have some systematic way of trying to capture that?
So is one way that we can do this with a survey?
One simple way to do it would be via survey. But let me give you an example, by the way, of a small business that I think has done a great job of trying to capture what's going on in their with their customers, and we often think that well, you have to be a very large business in order to actually have any information system. But I have a local florist, and this local florist is someone that I have called to order flowers for my mother-in-law and when for her birthday. And what I discovered is they have a little index card, and they wrote down that I ordered flowers from them. And they contacted me like 10 days before my mother-in-law's birthday to remind me that her birthday was coming up. So first of all, they have an information system that knows who their customers are and when it is that they do order. But then secondly, if I end up not reordering, then they already know something about the non-retention or, you know, how they have not been able to keep me continuing to use them. Now, it could be for a variety of reasons. It could be I wasn't satisfied with what it is that they did, or it could be totally different and that I wanted to move on and get something different this next year. So I use that as an example of how a small business could really be doing something very systematic and trying to capture what's going on.
A wonderful example, too, because we don't have to have anything other than an index file card, maybe with you know, a Rolodex type system with a month indicator and a piece of paper, you know, with the little clips in there, and you could write the information down. So every month you could just scroll through by the day and see if there's anyone to contact that day.
Right, and sort of here was an example of being able to get retention data without ever having to do a survey of any type, just being able to look at your own number of customers and what percent are coming back.
Wonderful idea. So we've already gotten two ways to do it. One is the natural way that you're describing, but I guess for people who may not have done this from the very beginning, is a survey kind of a good way to come out of the box if you don't have any information like that, that maybe you at least have email addresses so you can maybe send a survey and perhaps even attach a coupon to it as an incentive to get people to sort of help you begin to populate your database with that information.
Right. So a survey would be a really easy way to do it. Part of the key is making sure that when you do the survey from one period to the next, that you end up doing that in the same fashion year over year. Are you having trouble hearing me, by the way?
I am, but you know what? I think we may be able to see if we can fix that during our break when it's now time for our break. We're talking with Professor David Reibstein, the co-author of Marketing Metrics, the definitive marketing performance. This is Indie Business Podcast. We'll be right back.
Why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Podcast. I want to apologize to you guys for any difficulties you might have had hearing some of the information that was shared in the first segment. It was some really good information. Of course, you know I'm going to summarize the podcast at my blog. So if you missed any of the first part of it because you couldn't hear, you can always check the blog later because I write a text summary of some of the best tips that are shared by my guests. So you'll be able
And I am back.
To get the information there. And welcome back, Professor. So I think the sound is much better. Thank you so much for calling back in. So during our first segment, we talked about some fantastic ideas that you had for collecting information and sort of measuring the customer satisfaction level. Let's talk a little bit during our second segment, if we could, about social media. There's, of course, social media is such a general term, and we can sort of don't have time to delve too deeply into it. But one of the questions that I hear from small businesses most frequently is, you know, I can do all this stuff and social media and Facebook and Twitter, and it's a lot of fun. And I do see my customers responding, and every now and then I can track a sale through from a communication on Facebook or Twitter or some other social networking tool. Professor, what would you say about how we could generally use tools like that to market effectively? And then what are your tips or suggestions or ideas on how to track the effectiveness of that kind of outreach?
Well, first of all, one of the things that you can do is most say something on Facebook or Twitter is watching some of the communities grow and to directly to the number of participants that are on your Facebook. You are able to follow any of the communications that end up happening, and it's really interesting to be able to just visually be able to see the amount of activity that's happening around there. But to your second question, which is really one of how do you go about trying to monitor and track what's going on and how effective it is, the best thing and the easiest thing is to run experiments. And by that I mean you could place something in a on Twitter and see what the lift is, see what the impact is. You can go through a period of not placing anything there and not tweeting and be able to see some of the particular differences that end up happening. So it's that ability to do the direct comparison which allows you to sort of track what the impact is of any of those particular activities. I should mention, by the way, that all of this social media that we talk about and buzz and viral marketing, those are all things that have existed for a long, long time before the Internet. There was always the buzz or the communication from one individual to another individual. What's happened with the Internet is our ability to be able to track and see it happening and the speed in which it happens as well.
And would you also say, Professor, that for small business owners, the Internet has directly impacted those things, but also our ability to actually start those conversations?
The answer is absolutely. So I'm involved. I'm on the board of advisors of a company that's called Merchant Circle, and it is strictly for local retailers.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability that they've had to start the conversation within their own local communities has been just tremendous.
And that is such good news because, as you said, we can always track things coming back to us, but being able to start them gives us, would you agree, the ability to plan them in advance a little bit more so you can schedule certain things and carve out time in your busy schedule, because we're talking to business owners that wear pretty much all the hats. And if you do as you say, which is kind of, you know, try something out and then go back to Twitter or go back to Facebook and do things like, what do you say? See if anybody retweeted it or see if how many people responded to it. How do you actually look at it and say, was this worth my time? Was it effective? Is it going to help me serve my customers better?
So you should be able to, when you post something, see whether or not that has an impact on your sales. And so ultimately what it is you're interested in is the number of customers that you're getting and what kind of revenue it is you're getting from that activity. So it's one thing to see them tweeting each other or more people joining the particular posting, but you ultimately want to see what that bigger impact is on your sales.
And you know, what's interesting about that is that a little bit harder? It's a little bit harder to track, right? Because people don't always say, like, if I've been following you on Twitter for a while, let's just say, for example, and I know you're an author and I've heard about your books and people have been buzzing about them for a while, and then I subscribe to your newsletter and then I heard about you in my local paper and saw a little segment on TV about you. And then I go buy your book because after 2 weeks of hearing how great you are, I think I need to buy it. How can someone in that author's position or anybody selling anything else, what are your tips on actually how to track that? Do you put a place for people to answer the question, where'd you hear about me, in the sales form?
You can, but I will tell you, by the way, that's not totally reliable because people will answer, but sometimes you see things and you hear things and you don't know what it is that influenced you or you're more willing to comment about having heard it, you know, from a friend than you are about having seen it placed in an ad somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's
some pretty good evidence that that's not as reliable as one would like.
Okay.
And then to your broader question, you know, the reality is it is hard to try and track exactly how much that overall impact is. And it just is one of the complexities, which is why it sort of is useful to try different experiments so you can see what happens when I am, you know, tweeting or posting and how much it has an impact when you stop doing it as well.
So what you can kind of do then, Professor Wright, is you can kind of plan, you know, three or four things over the course of a month that you're going to try, and you try them, and then you look at the response that you get that you can tangibly see in terms of you know, people responding or people sharing that information with their friends. And then you go back at the end of the month and you look at the sales figures and do you look for spikes that you can associate with certain outreach actions that you've taken and certain behaviors that you've been involved in?
Yeah, you said it much better than I did. It's exactly that. You look at those spikes that are correlated with things that activities that you take.
Okay, good. All right. So you know, it doesn't sound so... It sounds time-consuming, but it doesn't sound hard.
No, it really isn't that complex.
Okay. Good. So
And it shouldn't be that time-consuming. It's relatively straightforward. and it's relatively costless also.
Okay, let's talk about then how do we make it more efficient? How do we make it take up less time? Do we do the same four things every month so we don't have to make it up as we go, and that will build in some efficiencies? What are your tips for making it take up less time? Because it's so important, you can't not do it.
Right. And I actually think there's advantages to not doing the same thing every month. And that allows you to go ahead and track, you know, if I did something different this month than I did last month, then if I get a bigger spike this month, that there's some real learning there as well.
What if the repetitive thing works? Do you?
So if it turns out that the repetitive thing works, then you're going to find by not repeating it, you're going to find that there's some decline that ends up happening and you go back to doing the repetitive thing. So just by doing the variation, you'll be able to see what might work and what you're going to find out what doesn't work as well.
Okay. Okay, and so when you work with other companies, I know you mentioned the florists a little bit earlier. Have you noticed any of the companies that you've worked with being able to do this on places like Facebook and Twitter effectively and efficiently? And if you'd like to focus on Facebook more than Twitter, that's fine, because most of our listeners are more involved on Facebook than they are on Twitter.
So, you know, lots of talk about Facebook and Twitter and so forth, but it turns out that while that doesn't necessarily work for everybody. So I don't want to give a blanket statement that says, oh, Facebook and Twitter, it is the panacea. You know, I think there's more hype than there is necessarily results in reality. And so you get some partial results, but it doesn't always work.
And so what other things would you suggest then?
So I suggest trying Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, there may be some like LinkedIn as another one that is very much for business-to-business type of social networks. And the other side is maybe social networks isn't the thing for you.
And so what are some of your...
I don't want to jump on the bandwagon to say that the panacea for every business is social networking.
Well, I'm glad you said that because that's what we need to hear. Outside of that, I mean, they are free, and I think that's why a lot of small business owners, why it's appealing. And, of course, I like that you said, you know, try it out. We certainly don't want to ignore it, right? But what are some of the other things outside of that that you think can be effective, again, for very small business owners?
So it's not unusual to think about, I'm going to actually buy keywords, and I'm going to do that on Google or Yahoo, and that's not free. But what you can do is you can track exactly how much it is you're spending to get a visitor, and you can see of those visitors that I get via Google or Yahoo, what it is that their activity and behavior actually is. And so you can see whether or not it's worthwhile. So maybe you buy a keyword that might cost you, I'm going to make up a number here, that might cost you $1 to buy that keyword, but of every visitor that I get, I 25% of them end up buying, and they end up buying something that averages about $20. I make 50% on those, so I make about $10. So I spend $1 for every one of those visitors. I got 20 visitors. That cost me $20. It wasn't worthwhile. But you could work through the particular numbers and find out whether or not those keywords are really worth it. And again, it's not that complex.
Right, right. And isn't it also true, Professor, that you mentioned Google and Yahoo, and of course there are a lot of other ones. Facebook has a pretty robust advertising program. But all of those companies provide some pretty helpful metrics, if you will, and pie charts and statistics by the day to let you know what is happening with people who click on your ad or on your keyword.
That's right. So they do a good job of providing some data, and part of what the purpose of them of the book is to allow you to make sure you can understand. You get all these charts, It tells you what, you know, pass-through rate is. You want to know, well, what's that? And drop-off rate, what's that? And various different measures that you might be getting from some of those, your Google metrics. And you need to be able to understand what they're talking about.
Excellent suggestions from our guest today, Professor David Reibstein, co-author of Marketing Metrics, The Definitive Guide to Measuring Marketing Performance. We're going to take our final break and come back, and we're going to ask the professor to share some of his best tips for correctly pricing your products, raising product prices if you need to, and everything that we can fit into a few minutes having to do with pricing your products to sell. This is the Indie Business Podcast. I'm your host, Donna Maria. We'll be right back.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests, recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
So that's the question. We're talking with David Reibstein, and he is a professor of marketing at Wharton School of Business in Pennsylvania. And how exciting is it to get the kind of expertise and insights and knowledge from a professor at one of our nation's most well-respected business schools right here on the Indie Business Podcast. So, Professor Reibstein, let's talk about pricing. You have a lot of information in your book to help people do that, and I encourage everyone to go and pick up a copy of Marketing Metrics. You can get it on Amazon, and just Google it. Lots of other places that you can buy it as well. Let's talk about pricing, Professor. What are some of the basic tenets that people need to keep in mind when they're pricing their products?
Well, there's various ways that one can set price, and one of the ways is by looking at your costs. And the key is making sure you account for all of your costs, but looking at your costs and adding some particular margin on top of that. A second way is by looking at what your competition's charging and then trying to assess how much better or worse you are than your competition. And when I say worse, how much more of a discount you're going to have to offer relative to your competitors or what kind of premium you can charge. And the third way of setting prices, I think it's by far the best, but it's clearly the most difficult, is trying to think about what's the value of what it is that you're offering to your customers, and then setting that as the upper limit of what it is that you can be charging, and then trying to decide of that total value of what is it worth to the customer, then trying to share in that value with the customer. Now, what I want to do in your mind is position that the value sort of defines the upper limit of what it is to charge, and your cost really defines the lower limit of what it is that that you can charge. And that value is really value relative to the other alternatives that that they happen to have in front of them. So there's lots of ways I could go through a number of examples of trying to think about the value of a product. But let me just stop right there and see what questions that sort of lead you down.
Well, thank you for doing that because, of course, you know me. I do have some questions. The first thing you said was making sure you account for all your costs and then add a margin on top. A lot of people get stuck there because once they figure out their costs, which is, as I know you would say, is quite a mechanical process. You get out a calculator and you do some calculating. You have a number for the production of this particular product. And then you could double it, or you could triple it, or you could quadruple it. Let me just ask you this. If the market will bear a quadruple cost, all other things being equal, is it a no-brainer in that case?
If the market will bear it, it's pretty much a no-brainer.
Okay.
And,
all right,
and so what it is that you're referring to when you say, will the market bear it, is, you know, implied in that is, so what's it worth to them? If they're willing to pay four times what it costs me, then it must be worth a lot to them.
You can partially find that out, as you said earlier, by looking at what other people are charging. If other people are charging quadruple what it costs you, and you can kind of look at your competitors and see if they're using the same ingredients or basically have the same basic same business structure, you can get an idea that you could probably approach that price.
Right.
Okay.
So it sort of is interesting. There are tons of examples that sort of give you radically different types of results. There's a company called the Medicines Company. It's up in Boston. It was a small little company. They created a product called AngioMax, and it was really to deal with patients that have had heart surgery, and it would dramatically decrease the complications of the hospitals. They were selling it in the hospitals, and the previous product that was being used was called Halperin, and they were charging like $1 or $2 per dosage per patient. But because of the reduction in complications for the patients, hospitals saw that they saved tremendous amounts of money by using AngioMax over Halperin. And the value to the hospital, not to mention to the patient and the patient's life, was considerable, such that they were willing to pay in the hundreds of dollars, even though competition was only charging $1 to $2. And so this small little company, the Medicines Company, was actually able to be very, very successful by not thinking just in terms of what their costs are, but by thinking about what's the value of this to their customers.
That's an excellent example. I appreciate that you shared that. And you said that's often the most difficult way to make the determination, figuring out what the value is to people. Is that something that you do your best at evaluating at the beginning, and then you kind of just have to constantly reassess it as you ramp up your business?
You should definitely be trying to do that for certain product categories. You know, one of the ones that you and I chatted about was like thinking about cosmetics. It's really hard to think about what's the value of this fragrance or this cosmetic over another one. But when you're talking about products that might provide time saving or increased productivity or what would have to be paid for to get solved in another way, then it's much easier to do that type of calculation. It is the type of thing that you should be doing, you know, from the inception. Because once you set a price in the customer's mind that this is what the value is, then it's very hard to try and raise your price afterwards.
Well, that's a good thing to remember. And that's what a lot of small businesses find themselves in the position, though. It's because so many of our listeners really didn't set out to start a business. They kind of set out making something that they enjoyed making, and maybe people showed up around the holidays to purchase it, and suddenly the bank account in January was looking a lot better than it did the month before. So they kind of think, well, maybe I could do this, you know, a little longer. So let me ask you this. That being the case, since so many people just happen to find themselves there without reading your book or listening to this radio show first, what are your tips for raising those prices when, as it turns out, you just have no choice if you're going to have a profitable business?
Right. So first of all, it's always easier, and one of my pieces of advice would always be start with a higher price rather than a lower price, only because, well, there's two reasons. One, it's always easier to lower price than it is to raise price, and the second reason is that there might be some customers out there that are willing to pay that higher price, and you might as well discover them before you go down in price to find those that are willing to pay a lower price. And then the third reason is that by starting with a higher price, it does something about communicating the value of what it is that you're offering. So some people infer the quality of what you're offering from the price that you set. So my advice is always start higher and then work your way down.
You know, it's really interesting that you said that. Is that you can build additional financial benefits into your business bottom line by setting a higher price from the very beginning, because you communicate more value when you do that. All other things being equal, that's part of the message people get when they first see your product.
Yeah, without question.
That's a really, it's interesting that you said that. I had a meeting last week with a book publisher, and as we were talking, they were showing me a lot of the books in their catalog, and they were talking to me about book covers and how a book cover portrays a specific value of that book to customers. They say, you know, never judge a book by its cover, but they were giving me all kinds of reasons why you should do that. And as they were showing me different books, the same book published by two different companies, and what the cover looked like and what the texture felt like and how the light bounced off the cover and all those sorts of things, they shared about being able to price that book at a higher price, not because of the information that was in it, but simply because of how it was packaged.
Yeah. No, that's for sure. And
I know for some reason we're not able to hear you right at this moment, but I heard a little bit of what you said, and I know it was sort of agreeing with the sort of concept that the publisher was sharing. So, you know, it's interesting that you're talking about being able to have that kind of control in your business. Most small business owners don't really have the mindset to think of themselves as being in control of that many things when they first start. But what you're saying is that we really do control more things than we think we do when it comes to the messaging and the creation of whatever mindset we want our customers to have when they hear about our brand.
There really is a lot that we have control over. And what we were referring to earlier is the impact we have of setting the impressions that customers have of our products or services by either our packaging, like the book cover, or the prices that we set. And the prices communicate a lot about the quality of what we have to offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thinking about small business, imagine, you know, somebody wants to get somebody to paint their house. There's lots of data that indicate that customers do not take the cheapest one that's offered to them because they assume it must not be as much quality as the ones that were bids that were given at higher price. So the prices communicate something about the perceived quality of what you're going to get.
Right. And that's something that's a difficult thing for a lot of very small businesses and startups to understand. If they don't have a lot of the business acumen and business experience, they've been approaching things from a consumer perspective. So a lot of this really is sort of in the mindset that you approach your business with, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, this is great. So I want to let everyone know where they can go to learn more about you, Professor. Of course, the book is called Marketing Metrics, The Definitive Guide to Measuring Marketing Performance, and of course it's on Amazon. Can you share with us a little bit more about where we can find out more about you?
If you would go to the Wharton website, and there, I have my own website on there, and you could look up Wharton faculty and then look up my name, and there would be a whole bibliography about me.
Great.
Also, if you went to Amazon, there's a hot link right to my name that would just take you to all of my bio and all of my information.
Okay. Now, I have one unrelated question, totally unrelated to marketing metrics, but I'm curious about something. I've had a show for 5 years, and I've never had a guest that had three co-authors for their book. What was it like to put together a resource like this with four people?
The coordination is not always easy, but being able to work with others that bring in different perspectives, you can sometimes say you have too many chefs in the kitchen, but if you get the chefs working together, you can really make a wonderful meal. And I think having different perspectives and people doing different parts of it really made a much richer combination than we would have been able, certainly than I would have been able to do individually.
Well, I can vouch for that, having spent some time reviewing some of the great concepts that you share in this book. Thank you so much, you and your co-authors, for making this information so widely and readily available. And thank you, Professor. David J. Reibstein is William Stewart Woodside Professor and Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. This is a fantastic combination of information that we can all get. You can check out Amazon for the Marketing Metrics book. And as the professor said, you can find Wharton School on the Internet and find him that way. And by the way, his name is spelled R-E-I-B as in boy, S-T-E-I-N. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor.
Thank you very, very much.
Next week, we'll have Jeannie Bliss. She is the author of I Love You More Than My Dog. And she's going to join us to talk about how to drive customer focus and become a beloved and prosperous company. I guess the idea is to get your customers to love you more than they love their dog. And I would imagine that's not such an easy thing to do. But in today's environment, I think you gotta do your best, because if people love you and their dog about the same, then you probably have a pretty good outreach and a pretty good customer base. It's something that we all need to think about and strive for. That's next week right here on the Indie Business Podcast. Until then, enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.